This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of culture from your friends at NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
And I'm Felix Contreras, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk and jazz blogger for A Blog Supreme.
Just a reminder, if you haven't already, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
guitarist and rocker Lenny Kravitz reflects on the 20th anniversary of his debut album, Let Love Rule. Wu-Tang Clan member RZA waxes philosophical about his new book, The Tao of Wu.
And comedian Tracy Morgan gets emotional in a conversation with Fresh Air's Terry Gross. But first,
some real music to your ears. Musical training can improve your hearing. That's the conclusion of several studies presented recently in Chicago before the Society of Neuroscience. The studies found that serious musicians can perceive and remember sounds better than the rest of us. I don't know about that, but let's find out from NPR's John Hamilton.
Sounds come in through the ears, but they travel through our nerves and get interpreted by our brains. Nina Kraus, who directs the Auditory Neuroscience Lab at Northwestern University, says that means your hearing can change even if your ears don't.
Your hearing system becomes tuned by the experiences that you have had with sound throughout your life.
Kraus figured the hearing systems of musicians ought to be more finely tuned than those of other people. So she tested their ability to do something that's challenging for most of us, understanding what someone is saying in a noisy room. 15 classically trained musicians and 16 non-musicians listened to a simple sentence. First, they heard it without any background noise.
Sugar is very sweet.
Then, against a backdrop of quiet conversations.
Sugar is very sweet.
And finally, competing with some pretty loud conversations.
Sugar is very sweet.
Standard hearing tests had shown that the musicians' ears weren't any more sensitive than other listeners. But Kraus knew that their brains, shaped by years of training, had become very good at a similar task.
A musician will be listening to the sound of his own instrument, even though many other instruments are playing.
Not unlike separating one voice from a crowd of voices.
So we wondered, would this skill, which involves your hearing, would it transfer from the music domain into the speech domain? And resoundingly it does.
Kraus says a closer look at musical brains may explain why. Tests show that sounds produce stronger electrical signals in musicians' brain stems, and these signals offer a more accurate representation of pitch, timing, and tone quality, three things that help us pick out a single voice in a noisy room. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Where does that leave a guy like Pete Townsend?
That's a good question.
Well, the guy, what's his name, plays guitar for AC/DC. I mean, those guys, they've done some damage. Pete Townsend is famous for having some serious ear problems.
Music giveth and it taketh away a little bit, yeah?
That's pretty much it. And now from a story about serious musicians to a story about a guy who's not very serious at all.
Yeah, most of the time he's not. 30 Rock actor and former Saturday Night Live comedian Tracy Morgan has earned a reputation as a little bit of a wild card. He often blurs the line between his 30 Rock character, Tracy Jordan, and his real-life persona, especially in interviews over the last few years. But he exposes a different side of himself in his book, I Am the New Black, which tells the story of his childhood in what he calls Ghetto USA. In an excerpt from an emotional interview with Fresh Air's Terry Gross, Morgan describes the neighborhood where he grew up.
Well, it was rough. It was Bed-Stuy, do or die. You know, it was rough. It was deprivation. It was poverty. It was ghetto USA. It was what it was. But there was love. There was a lot of love, you know. But then crack came along and guns came along and, you know, it became an epidemic in America.
Your father fought in Vietnam, and you say he fought for like four or five tours, and he came home addicted to heroin, and that kind of split up the family because your mother didn't want you around him when he was using.
Of course not. My mother loved my father. My mother tried to help my father, but when you're addicted to heroin, that's a very powerful addiction, and most people never survive it. And like many other young men that went over and served in Vietnam, a lot of them came back junkies.
I know, but
that's how heroin and all of these things took place in the 70s. It was a big boom on that. It was young kids over there just trying to get through the night.
When you were six or seven and you know, your father was freshly home and you were trying to get to know him, did you understand what it meant to have a habit? And here's what I'm even thinking, you know.
No, I was 6 years old.
I know, and kids are so afraid of needles, you know, of getting like vaccinations
old.
And shots. And here your father
is. I knew my
is...
daddy was sleepy all the time.
Uh-huh.
That's all I knew. But he was my daddy.
Right.
Kids don't see fault like that. Kids' minds ain't even that developed.
Yeah, I'm also wondering, like you write about how your father would have night terrors from post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, and that would make me cry because my daddy was scared and I knew that. And I was a baby, but I seen it.
Yeah, but I figure that must have been really scary to see your father scared like that.
Oh, you don't know the half. This book is just the half. People are really shocked about some of the things and revelations that are made in this book, but you don't even know the half. There are people still, I know people going through this every day. You know, I know people going through this every day. My childhood, yeah, sure, it wasn't a happy ending. I lost my daddy. And at some point, I lost my mommy emotionally, but she had five kids.
Yeah, well, you write about how you left your mother's home in Brooklyn to live in your father's home in the Bronx when you were in high school.
I thought it was because I wanted to play football and she didn't want to let me.
And now
but
what
I
do you think?
I think it was bigger than that. Now that I look back on it now, I think that I ran because if I would have stayed, I might have became a statistic like some of my other friends.
What
I might have got caught up in the streets, and I might not be sitting here talking to you. So I did what I thought was best for me, and I ran, and I went to my father, who put me in a high school with a football team, and said, run, Trey, have fun. And by the time I really got to know him, I was still going through anger, because I was still angry. I was like any other inner-city child with a chip on his shoulder because his daddy and his mommy wasn't together.
And I should say, when you went to live with your father, he wasn't using anymore, right?
No, he had stopped maybe 10 years.
Yeah, yeah, I just wanted to
but it was
make
too
that
late.
Mm-hmm,
yeah, it was too late. He wasn't using then. My father was, he was down like four flat tires at that time, but I was angry. He was always in my life. My father was always there, taught me how to, took me fishing and all these things. But it's not like having daddy there.
When your father died of AIDS when you were in high school, you dropped out of high school and you needed money. So you say you started selling marijuana and then eventually started selling crack.
Yeah.
But so I'm wondering, did you take Al Pacino's advice from Scarface, don't get high on your own supply?
No, I never did drugs. My drug of choice was beer, was liquor. As far as narcotics, no. I would smoke weed and drink beer like any other. Like Michael Phelps do that. But I never did no narcotics. Never. My father had died from that, so I already knew better. You know, I'm a very smart person. I was able to see that. I was, as a child, I was able to know that I wanted a better life.
You say that it was helpful to you as a comic to sell crack because of all the characters that you met. What do you mean?
Well, it wasn't helpful for me to sell crack, especially to my old community. It still bothers me today, but it's something that I did. It was survival. Now I'm living. Now I don't have to do any of that stuff. I'm a grown man now. But when I did, I wasn't good at it. So I had my fledgling attempt at being a drug dealer.
So, but tell me really, like, how did you feel when you were selling crack, knowing that you were selling a drug that destroys
lives? I had no fear.
Mm-hmm.
I was crazy. And when you don't have fear, you're crazy. I didn't have a healthy dose of fear. I was like everybody else doing it. I never thought I could get killed or somebody could kill me. And then friends started dying. Friends started going to jail. I know guys that are doing years in the hundreds. I know people that never made it out of our childhood. My best friend, who I used to sell crack with, got murdered one day. Murdered by somebody we went to junior high school with. And that was it for me. I started doing comedy.
After that?
Right after that. Because me and him used to be cooking the drugs up, and he would say to me, yo, Tracy, man, you should be doing comedy. You should take your ass to the Apollo. And I was like, nah, man. And then a week later, he was murdered. And that, for me, that was like my Vietnam.
You know, I have to say, I really encourage people, if you find that interesting, to go ahead and listen to the rest of the interview, which is available at the website, npr.org, because it is really fascinating and quite a lengthy exchange. And I've heard that guy interviewed quite a bit, and that's the only interview like that with him that I've ever heard. Remember the times we used to play. We sing and we dance all damn day.
But all I do is sing the blues. Hey, Linda, you hear that?
I do.
It's hard to believe it's been 20 years since that came up.
Indeed, Lenny Kravitz's first rock album, Let Love Rule, came out 20 years ago. And at first, Americans didn't know how to categorize him. But today, he's firmly established himself as one of the great rock musicians of our time. Lenny Kravitz grew up surrounded by show business in New York and Los Angeles. His father was a TV producer and promoter. His mother was an actress. Kravitz found his unique voice in music. NPR's Ari Shapiro asked him about how he developed his distinctive sound.
When you started making music, did you have the Lenny Kravitz sound from the beginning, or did it take time to find
it? No, it found me. I wasn't even really looking for it. At the time, I was in Los Angeles, and I was playing for other people.
Backup, you mean?
Yeah, I'd play bass, I'd play drums, I'd play guitar, depending on what the band was. I was just trying to play. I'd be doing recording sessions for people that were trying to make records and get deals. And one day I just woke up and I was just tired of it because there was this sound that I was hearing, but these people weren't doing it. And I kind of just stopped and got quiet, and all of a sudden this stuff started coming out of me. I had no record deal. I wasn't looking for a record deal at the time. I was just living, and it just came, and it came in the form of Let Love Rule.
And at first people weren't really sure what to make of it.
Well, when I started taking it around, people were, I think they were not expecting music that had so much rock and roll in it. They were expecting hip-hop.
Was that because of racial pigeonholing?
Yeah, of course. I mean, everybody likes to put things in a box. And in 1988-89, when I was putting it together, if you were black, that's what you were supposed to be doing, you know? Yeah.
Is that part of the reason you spend a lot of your time in Paris? You relocated to Paris. There seems to be a long history of American artists who Americans try to pigeonhole, moving to Europe and finding that they're not pigeonholed as easily when they go over there.
Well, the interesting thing was the gentleman, Jeff Aroff, who signed me, who I still thank to this day for giving me a life, he said, I believe in your music, but I don't know that it's going to sell. I can't tell you that it's going to sell, but I can tell you that I believe in it. And what they did was, when the record first came out and they saw the sort of American reaction that was going on, they sent me to Europe. So got on a plane, went to London for the first time, went to Germany, went to Hamburg, went to Paris, went to Holland, went to Amsterdam, and started in this area and just started playing festivals, small festivals, playing clubs, and that's where it really happened. I think they were still wondering why I wasn't doing hip-hop, because I was asked that every day, but at the end of the day, they were open-minded to accept it. And yes, there is a great history of African-American artists going to Paris, and it sounds romantic, you know? I like that. But I've always loved Paris. I fell in love with Paris before I even got there, because I've always been into architecture. And I'm partial to Parisian architecture. So I actually live over there, half the year now.
You should check out the whole interview with Lenny Kravitz on our website, npr.org/culturetopia. It's really, really insightful.
Absolutely. And, I have to say this week we have really been, we've gotten around this week. We have had science. We have had comedy. We have had Lenny Kravitz. And I think, it's only logical that you would go from there to soap operas.
There you go.
Outside the United States, the next cool thing is television. That's the argument of Charles Kenny, an economist at the World Bank. In Foreign Policy magazine, he writes about the soap operas and other programs that reach the developing world and says that TV is changing those areas even more than the internet because it simply reaches more people. NPR's Steve Inskeep spoke to Kenny about TV's impact around the world.
I have to admit that Baywatch is the most popular program we think ever. Some of the episodes have been watched by 1 billion people. And it does have, one can argue, some value. I mean, a lot of the moral messages in Baywatch are actually quite positive. Do the right thing is a fairly constant endpoint for a Baywatch show. So even these shows that normally we think of as just being cotton candy for the mind actually can have quite a powerful positive influence on people's lives.
We were sitting around the office here speculating on why Desperate Housewives might be one of the most popular programs in the world right now.
Indeed it is. I think Desperate Housewives and House are two very popular programs. The most important thing is it's entertainment. They enjoy it. Why should we be upset by that? But also, even some of these soaps, we're seeing quite a large impact. There are cases in both Brazil and India where quite careful research has been done. And it suggests that people watching soaps, it's really changing the way they live their lives, especially for women.
And why is it that television has that effect on people?
Well, to take the example of Brazil, Rede Globo is the big TV station in Brazil. It broadcasts a lot of local soaps. Most of what people are watching in the developing world is not Baywatch and House, for all their popularity. It's locally made programming, and a lot of that is soap operas. On the soap operas in Brazil, the vast majority of women have no children or one child. When Rede Globo started broadcasting in Brazil, the average Brazilian woman had about 6 children. They start watching these shows and they see these women with very few children, much more independence within the household. And it seems to have an effect on the way they live their lives. One of the ways you can tell that is that the names of the women characters on the TV program start to become very popular names to name your kids. Mm. But also, we actually saw, for example, the divorce rate go up. Now, I'm not saying that's a pure good, but it does suggest something about the power relations between men and women within the household.
You're talking about a heavily Catholic country here and talking about smaller family sizes and higher divorce rates. Has there been a backlash?
Not one that we've seen aimed at Rede Globo. However, the general feeling that one gets in the United States is the same the world over, that we've seen some people say, this is culturally very damaging. There have been fatwas against watching TV in India, for example.
You also write about a Muslim cleric who said it was okay to kill television executives.
Yes. I'm glad to say that's an extreme example, and we haven't seen terribly much of that. This is in Saudi Arabia, and people are worried that TV can be a force for cultural change. I would just argue that some cultural change is good cultural change.
Earlier in the podcast, we heard from Lenny Kravitz, who did not do hip-hop, and now we're going to hear from the Wu-Tang Clan, a band that disbanded several years ago, but is considered one of the most influential hip-hop groups in history. The man behind Wu-Tang is Robert Dix, better known to his fans as RZA, that's R-Z-A. He grew up in various housing projects in New York, and he also has a new book called The Tao of Wu, and he writes that these places taught him very important life lessons. He told NPR's Guy Raz where Wu-Tang fits into the history of hip-hop.
Yeah, I think we came in the early 90s, sort of like we ushered in a new generation. We was from Staten Island, which was a borough in New York that wasn't on the hip-hop map to the world. And we had developed our style of hip-hop and our style of slang, which we coined the Wu-Tang slang. And when we had the opportunity to get it to the world, we did. We had to sell it out of the back of our trunks and make demos and all that. Eventually we made noise, and Steve Rifkin from Loud Records got a copy of the music, made us a very low-end deal that led to success for all of us.
Socrates, philosophies, and hypotheses. Can't define how I be dropping these mockeries. Lyrically perform armed robbery.
We're hearing the song Triumph by the Wu-Tang Clan, also an early hit by the band in the early 90s. When you hear this song, where does it take you? Where does it take you back to?
Oh, man, this song right here, you hear some of the illest lyrics ever written. Inspector Deck starts this song off with, "I bomb atomically. Socrates' philosophies and hypotheses can't define how I'll be dropping these mockeries. Lyrically, perform armed robbery. Flee with the lottery. Possibly, they spotted me." Man, this guy, within just 4 lines, you get a whole well of information. I think that one song is almost good enough to make a book out of.
In your new book, it's sort of a series of lessons, 7 lessons that you learned along your journey in life. You talk about as a kid living in a 2-bedroom apartment, sometimes with 19 people living there. You had a pretty tough life as a kid in the projects in Staten Island, New York. What lessons did you draw from that?
Beyond make sure you eat first. I learned a lot from hardship, yo. I guess I was able to see the hardship and take the goodness out of it. You know, the book goes through different descriptions of, for instance, me getting beat up by a guy named Junjun, who was a tough dude that I would fight and he would beat me. But years later, he becomes my student. And I would teach him books and teach him things. He was a gangster, so he didn't really go to school and stuff like that. But
so
he
started teaching him?
Yeah, I started teaching him about mathematics, about certain books to read, how to open his mind. And he became, actually, even though he was a very aggressive dude, he had gained the spark of positivity in his life.
You've also scored soundtracks for directors like Quentin Tarantino and Jim Jarmusch, and you actually appeared in Jim Jarmusch's film Coffee and Cigarettes, and I want to play a bit of that scene where you're with Bill Murray.
I mean, this 50 milligrams alone have been proven to be fatal in a few minutes, man.
How much is in one cigarette?
3 milligrams. And did you know they also use nicotine for an insecticide to kill bugs?
I mean, it's good if it kills bugs, right?
But are you a bug, Bill Murray?
I love that scene. I want to ask you about scoring music, though. I read that you only started to learn how to read and compose music later in life.
When Jim Jarmusch came to me, he was like, he's doing a movie called Ghost Dog, and he loved Wu-Tang music, and he wanted me to put the score to it. I was like, well, I never did a score before. I went and actually got Peter and the Wolf. They had an animated version of Peter and the Wolf, but during the version, they had extra footage on the VHS that would tell you how this suite was composed, how he used the horns or the tubas for the wolves, how he used the flute for the bird, and every character had a musical instrument. And that information gave me an understanding of how to compose. And that's why when I composed Ghost Dog, on the first scene, when you see the bird flying in the air, there's a hip-hop beat underneath, but there's a flute playing to describe the bird. And I just started studying more Bernstein, Mancini, and now I do score Hollywood films.
Before we let you go, I got to ask you one more question. Chess. What's up with chess? What is it about that game that has you hooked?
Man, and I am hooked. Well, chess is like hip-hop, right? Hip-hop is a way that we found to express aggression, express even violence, without having to physically perform it. Chess is a duel. It's like a sword fight. But it's all done on 64 squares on the board. All your aggression, or all your strategy, all your cunningness is now left into a game. And to me, it's a way to get the energy out. One of my lyrics says, my remedy for stress is 3 bags of cess, a day in my rest, which is my house, playing chess.
And that's it for Culturetopia this week.
You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/Culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Felix Contreras. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.
smoking Joe Frazier, the hellraiser, raising hell with the flavor. Terrorize the jam like troops in Pakistan, swinging through your town like your neighborhood Spider-Man. So all tick-tock and keep ticking, will I get you flipping off the shit that I'm